Well, today is March 16th, 2010. I am in Chapel. No?
15th? It's the Wait, 16th, you're right.
Well, it's still the 16th. Well, I know or know it only because tomorrow's St. Patrick's Day, right? So I'm in Chapel Hill, North Carolina with Sandy Benigoni, and I'm conducting an oral history interview for the Betty H. Carter Women Veterans Historical Project Oral History Collection for the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Sandy, how would you like your name to be on your collection?
Probably Sandra, and then in parentheses, Sandy. And middle initial L in Benigoni.
Excellent. Okay, Sandy, let's start out by having you tell me when and where you were born.
I was born August the 3rd, 1940 in St. Louis, Missouri.
Do you have any brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters, an older sister and a younger sister. Parents, as I told you, were dad's Italian, mom was German. And one of the things that probably made an impact on my family was my biological mother died when I was 5, when my younger sister was born. She hemorrhaged at childbirth.
Oh, wow.
And my dad remarried, so I've always considered, and I've never called my second mom my stepmom. She was just my mom.
Yeah.
So I always said I had two moms.
Yeah. What did your father do for a living?
My second mom and my dad's fathers had a soda water company in St. Louis called Blue Ridge Bottling Company. So dad and his brothers, all the guys, were en route and delivering sodas. I grew up on Blue Ridge Bottling Company soda instead of milk as a kid.
What kind of soda is your favorite?
Root beer.
What was it like to grow up in St. Louis at this time?
I liked St. Louis. I mean, I was very active, and I just thought St. Louis was great. I still think St. Louis is great. I go back to visit most of my family, except one nephew. Everybody still lives in St. Louis. My parents are deceased, but sisters, nieces, nephews, etc., are still in St. Louis. One's in San Diego, but everybody else is back there. So go back there almost every year.
What kind of environment did you grow up in as far as, like, did you grow up in the town, the city of St. Louis?
Or yes, in the city.
Not the suburbs or anything like that?
No, in the city.
So what kind of things did you do in the city as a young girl?
I went to Catholic grade school and high school. So, and our grade school was very involved. Besides, and I did like school. Now I take that back. The first couple of years we were at a girls' school. That's because my mom had died and things all got transitioned. And until the middle of second grade, I was at this all-girls school. And I hated it because they had pea soup every Friday and I didn't want to eat pea soup. And I'd cry every Friday. But we finally went to this mixed Catholic school, grade school. And I went to high school, Catholic high school. But the thing I loved is that they had a lot of sports. I mean, since second grade, I was playing basketball and softball. And I love sports. I mean, I did it all through high school. And also, I became a Brownie and then a Girl Scout. And I went through Senior Scouts all the way through high school.
Came a cadet?
No, we were mariners. As Senior Scouts, we had our troop had a canoe and a sailboat, and so we were up on the Mississippi, and we would meet other troops from, like, Illinois and have great big, what we called GANs, and racing events and canoeing events and camping out and just have wonderful times. Very, very active. Of the three of us, the three girls, I'm the most active in sports and all that.
How fun. That actually sounds like a lot.
I loved it.
Yeah. So you had a sister older and a sister younger than you.
Three years older and 5 years younger.
Okay. And then your father's working for the family business.
Right. Until I was in eighth grade.
Okay.
And then my dad and my mom and his brother and his wife, in eighth grade, the four of them started a restaurant.
Oh.
And they had never done anything in the restaurant business before. It was a really courageous step. And I remember my cousin, Uncle Babe and Aunt Louise's daughter, we were in the same grade all the way through school. And Marlene and I were so upset because here we were getting a restaurant where we could go freebie and our parents wouldn't put pizza in. It was a nice family little Italian restaurant. And they wouldn't put pizza in and we were so angry. And the reason they wouldn't put pizza in is because they said teenagers will come in, get pizza and Coke, make a lot of noise and drive our good customers away. And they had that restaurant even though they moved location, but they were in the restaurant business for 23 years, and they never, ever had pizzas.
Did you always regret that?
No, I came to understand that they were probably right, but as an eighth grader, you wouldn't understand that.
Yeah, that's true. So what kind of things did you do? Now, the Girl Scouts and being on the Mississippi, that sounds actually like a lot of fun.
Oh, it was. We did a lot of camping events. We went to state parks and we were camping. And I love the competitiveness of, the sports, but also like when we had racing events and all that.
The canoeing?
Yeah. Canoeing and a sailboat.
And a sailboat. That's really
It was very nice. So that was all the way through high school.
Wow. What other kind of things did you do for fun?
Dance parties. Yeah. Pretty typical what you would expect.
Well, talk about the dances. What kind of dances were they?
Oh, they were mostly high school dances, although we had dances all the way in grade school. I remember even having a class of trying to teach us as 7th and 8th graders how to dance. And then we had square dancing. Mm-hmm. I come from a family that loved parties, both the Italian and German side of me. I remember as a child, my German grandparents belonged to this group called the Cellar Dons. And we asked them one time why they were named the Cellar Dons. Well, their parties would go in, usually in somebody's basement, the cellars, and they would party till dawn. There was reasons why they were called that. But I remember they had a picnic once a year, and we'd get to go with Grandma and Grandpa to the picnic, and it was outdoors, and they had this big lake. But they also had this big covered place where you would eat and, you know, sit if the sun was too hot. But they always brought this man to play piano. And he would play by ear. And any song that anybody came up with, he would play. And I remember singing for hours. To this day, people go, how do you know the words to all those old songs? And I'm going, I sang them as kids. Just loved it. So we were a very active family. Did a lot of parties.
Did a lot of family events together and things
yes.
like that, yeah.
Yeah. Always the holidays, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Do you have any earliest memories of growing up?
Yeah, sad. One of my earliest memories is my dad crying, and it must have been the day my mom died. And as a child, it used to always bother me if I thought I was going to do anything that dad would cry. I was very much, to this day, my sisters will even say it, that I was Dad's favorite. But Dad and I just really clicked. Mm-hmm. I always say it's our signs. He was a Sagittarius and I was a Leo. And Leo's best friends are Sagittarius. And, I mean, we did a lot of things together. Dad, in his free time, when he couldn't fish in the winter and he was off, he made a rat skeller in our basement.
He made
a rat skeller? All right. It's like a German... a bar and paneling, and it's just a fun place for parties and entertainment. But Dad retook this concrete basement, and you know, he always needed somebody to hold up the other end of the boards or go get this. And you know, my nickname was Mike, go get the hammer. And because I was supposed to be the Richard, I'm the second daughter, I was supposed to be the boy in the family. But we just had a great time together, and I learned to whistle with my dad. But that was one of my earliest memories. I really don't remember, to this day, and I think I just must have blocked it out, I don't remember, even though I was 5, my biological mom.
Yeah.
I'll use my older sister as reference, and I'll ask Meryl, like, okay, recently we were talking about whooping cough and, you know, shingles and all that again, and I said, did we have whooping cough? And she goes, I don't remember. But most of the time, she'll fill me in on history.
Oh, I
part
see.
Of it.
I see.
She's my good historian.
You got to have one of those in the family.
Yes. Yep. But I'd say for the most part we were a very happy family. My little sister had some trauma. The German side of the family, you didn't talk about death. And my sister was already in school, and when mom died, it was such a shock to everybody. I think my dad probably was in a state of shock for a long time, and I just never knew that. They closed out of our house. They moved my sister out of school. I mean, anything that you can think of that was traumatic. But I won't blame them. I think they were doing the right thing. But like instead of my sister staying in the school where she was with the support system, and she was 8, they moved her to an entirely different school, and she didn't get to play with any of her friends anymore. And funny enough, my younger sister had a lot of mixed feelings that she didn't know, because nobody told her for a long time what happened to her biological mother. It was weird, but it was the German side of the family that really kind of did that.
So
dealt with it.
So your mother died in childbirth. Mm-hmm. So your younger sister was the one.
Fine, she was fine.
Yeah.
It was a very heavy issue on a family.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember a lot of playing, a lot of games, a lot of outdoor activities. My Italian grandfather helping me learn how to ride a bicycle when I was a kid. St. Louis has alleys, you know, you have alleys down every street. And one Christmas I got a bicycle, and Grandpa Venigoni was helping me ride down the alleyway.
Down the alleyway, yeah. And did you have, like, neighborhood things that you did together with kids?
Oh, yeah. Well, my cousins lived next door, so there was three of them next door and a lot of kids in the neighborhood. And we loved whenever they were doing new construction, because when the workers went home at night, all the kids would play in the... Because you always had basements being built, so you had these deep things you could play in. And we played cowboys and Indians and cops and robbers and all kinds of things. Yeah, we had a lot of fun.
Did you go to any baseball games?
No, I really didn't. And yet my dad was a baseball fan. He almost was a pro baseball player. He was very good at baseball and came this close to going to the minor leagues. But somehow or another that didn't work out. But we didn't go to games. I think they were expensive. My older sister tells me we were poor, but I didn't know that at the time. I thought we were fine, just like everybody else. But she insists we were poor.
She remembers it.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't remember ever wanting for something that we didn't have.
Well, she's the oldest, you know. She has that, that older girl responsibility sort of thing going on. So, now, how about school? What did you think of school?
I love school.
Yeah. What did you love about it?
Learning was always, I mean, all the way through my doctoral program, there's something about exciting to the mind. I wasn't your brightest student. I'm a good, solid A-minus, B-plus, but I'm not your, you know, golden star. But I was a good student. And all the way through school, I loved it. I'm terrible in math and languages. When God gave out the 10 talents, I was over here running my mouth and talking and communication, and I missed foreign languages and math abilities. I remember sitting in the back of the room in high school eating lunch with some of the guys and girls in the back of the room, because we had this poor little nun. I think she was deaf, pretty deaf, and had visual problems, and we really couldn't catch what she was talking about in algebra. So we ate lunch. But I had a great high school. I loved high school. It was on the newspaper. I loved journalism. Did a lot of nice things in high school. I was a class president.
What kind of responsibilities did you have as class president?
You know, the only reason I remember that, Teresa, is because my slogan was, "You'll get no baloney with Venigoni."
That was your campaign slogan?
Yes.
Sounds like it worked. And so you're, let's say, you're born in 40, so the 50s are your formative years. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, I loved it. It was all your, you know, the wonderful dance music that you could dance with, and the cars. I remember the Ford. I remember, I couldn't wait to get a driver's license. I think I got it 2 days after I turned 16. And my parents trusted me with the car. It's like, oh, Lord. But we had a lot, I had a lot of friends in grade school and high school. And so we would do a lot of things together just as groups. Go to all the football games in high school, and basketball games and dances, whatever.
Did you play any of the sports in high school?
I played softball and I played volleyball. I don't remember basketball in high school. I may have. But I don't remember that distinctly. There's something else I was in. What else was... Junior Achievement. I was in Junior Achievement in high school.
What'd you do with that?
Newspaper. I had journalism and worked on the yearbook in high school, and then I had Junior Achievement and we ran a newspaper. Thought it was really cool. We got to go down and work at the St. Louis Globe Democrat or Post Dispatch. We had two newspapers at the time. So I really liked that.
What kind of jobs did you do there?
They just had us down twice, and we helped with, like, figuring out how to do the columns and how much you could do on one page, and it was really neat.
It's a neat way to get that hands-on.
Yes.
So you're in high school, you're class president.
And at some place. Don't ask me what year.
Whenever the Venigoni theme went.
Yeah.
And what did you have a sense for yourself as a young girl growing up in the 50s of what was available to you for your future?
No, I don't think I thought about it a lot. I remember one time in an English class, and I think it was my sophomore or junior year, we had to write a paper about what we wanted to do when we graduate. And don't ask me why. I wanted to join the Navy. And
I am, of course, going to ask you why.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I had two uncles that were in during World War II, but nobody that I knew was Navy. I loved Anchors Away, the song. Must have seen some movies or something somewhere, but I wanted to go into the Navy. And I remember the English teacher, I got a good as solid A on the paper, but she also made these comments about it's not something yet a woman would do, a young woman would do. And I was so taken back by those comments. I didn't quite understand it. But that was her impression of women in the military. I remember that.
Was that the first time you heard something like that about?
Mm-hmm. I didn't know anybody that was in the military. I mean, really know.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely didn't know any women. But I was so... I mean, to this day, it was like I never wound up in the Navy, but... I was so shocked by her comments. At least I got a good grade out of it.
Did you talk to her at all about it, or just kind of...
You know, I don't remember doing that on a one-to-one.
Yeah.
I just kind of let it be.
Mm-hmm.
But I was shocked, and later on I was even more shocked when I thought back about it.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody could probably have colored somebody's thinking in that, you know, in those years.
Mm-hmm.
By what their impression was. One of my neatest teachers, and I will never forget, can't tell you her name, but she was blind. But she, I can't remember even what she taught, but the students just absolutely loved her. She was very independent, was fascinated by her. I mean, she was so independent, and her watch and everything was a whole new experience for the students. She was a wonderful high school teacher.
Was she also a nun?
No. Oh, no. We had, I had the same religious order in grade school and high school. And a lot of priests in high school, but we also had a lot of lay faculty in high school.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty big high school. I graduated high school in 1958, and we had 425 students graduate. It was a pretty large high school.
Mm-hmm. Was that how your elementary school was, too, or was it smaller?
No, it was pretty large.
Pretty large.
Yeah. And we had, you know, all 8 grades together.
Mm-hmm. So you're going through high school,
uh-huh.
And you're... driving around in your car with your Bologna No Bologna sign. And what kind of music did you like to listen to?
Ah, it's the music of the 50s. I just loved all music. I grew up loving music. Like I say, singing with my mm-hmm. German grandparents. Whenever my dad was working, he always had something on, and he always whistled. And to this day, I remember whistling one time, and one of the nuns said, "Girls, don't whistle. It makes the Blessed Mother cry." And I went, "What?" So I still whistle.
Did you go to movies at all?
Oh, yeah. We had 2 not far from us at all. We usually went on a Friday.
Do you remember what you liked to watch? Or a favorite actor or actress or anything?
I especially like the musicals and the dance ones. I, to this day, don't watch murder, violence, scary things. When the music starts changing, I will... close my eyes and cover my ears. I know immediately, maybe it's a Leo thing. They also say if you've had a near-death experience, you have a hard time with violence. Mm-hmm. I don't remember a near-death experience, and I don't know how bad I really was. My sister tells me about the time, I must have been 3 or 4. Mom was still alive, my biological mother. My little sister wasn't born yet. And I had eaten a banana too fast. And apparently I was choking, and somehow or another my mother told my sister to call for help. And Marilyn to this day kids me and says, I sat there and thought, I have her life in my hands. I can either call or not call. But apparently I did okay. I don't think it was a near-death experience, but I know I have this thing about violence. I might as well not even spend money at a movie to go see it. I had a friend who told me a couple years ago, she and her daughter had gone see Pirates of the Caribbean. And I said, is it scary? And they said, no, it's a Disney movie. Well, in the beginning, I didn't really comprehend what was going on, and I was scared to death. And then I finally got into, wait a minute, what is this changing into skeletons? But no, I just can't do violence. So any of the musicals, I would love. And we also have in St. Louis, it's a wonderful thing called the Muni Opera. It's an outdoor theater. I think it's MUNY. It's still there to this day, and they have summer productions. And they always had, well, Mom used to get tickets, and so Mom, my older sister and Mom and myself and one or two of Mom's friends would go almost every show in the summer. But they also had free seats in the back. Anybody could come and get the free seats. They had like five or six rows of free seats. And we used to go to a lot of the plays there, especially the musicals. To this day, I love all the musicals. Yep. Did movies. Didn't do a lot of other things. Did some dating. Thought I fell in love with everybody I dated, but I really didn't.
Did you? So, at some point, did you have a sense of what you thought you might do, like go to college or what your future would be, or did your father and mother have any kind of idea?
I had this journey that I didn't know until I was like somewhere in my 50s that I could look back retrospectively and say this was my journey, but I didn't know it at the time.
Oh.
Or I believe in the statement of Helen Keller, life is a daring adventure or nothing at all. My life has been so wonderful, but it's been steps that I think I just followed. We had this wonderful discussion, and my second mom was Italian, and she had stopped grade school at eighth grade because her mother had died, and she was responsible as the oldest for her four other siblings. So Mom never went to high school, although I could never beat her in my life in Scrabble. I mean, and she read volumes, and she loved to read. So I think Mom was smarter than I was, and she didn't have a high school education. But and it was probably still very old school, but she very strongly swayed my dad that girls did not go to college. You either had a choice of going to secretarial school or nursing school. I had no plans of doing either of those. I had no plans, period, but I had no plans of doing either of those. So I said,
if you had a list, they would not have been on it.
No, I was really good in secretarial. I took a secretarial class in high school, and I was really good at typing and doing those reproduction things on that nasty purple sheets and all that, if you're old enough to remember those. But, nah, I didn't want to do that. So, got to thinking I better do something. So, there were two Catholic hospitals in St. Louis that had schools of nursing. And anybody that wanted to go to the good schools either took the test for one of those two. And, obviously, not everybody got in. Well, I was dumb enough at the time to only take one of the two tests. And it was meant to be providentially because I got in. And it was St. John's. It was a wonderful diploma school of nursing. Now,
what does a diploma school of nursing mean?
It was in the days where most of the nursing education was done through a hospital school of nursing. We received a diploma at the end of it. We did not get a Bachelor of Science nursing like the universities were doing. But those were starting, but my family could never have afforded a university. I think St. Louis University School of Nursing was there at the time, but that wasn't even in the cards. So I went to St. John's. Two of my best friends. Oh, the other thing I did in high school that was absolutely wonderful. Two friends and I during the summer were camp counselors. We had a ball. It was a very, very nice camp. It was a Catholic camp. We were at the girls' camp. There was a boys' camp several miles away. But it was a wonderful camp. Had horses, all kinds of crafts for the kids, swimming overnight for the older girls. It was really fun.
How many years did you get to do that?
Two. And then the two friends that I was there with, the three of us, were all at St. John's at the nursing school, so we all roomed together. Still friends to this day. It was just wonderful. And you lived there. It wasn't like a university. They had a big dorm and you lived there.
What was that like?
Oh, we had fun. We had lots of fun.
Explain some of this fun.
It was just a great group of people because everybody that was in the class was there together. And it was Sisters of Mercy and they were wonderful. Classes were great. Teachers were good. But we as a group really just really clicked the freshman class.
Did you get to do anything outside of the learning experience?
We had some leadership things because I remember going to a leadership group, just those that were in whatever it was called. I don't remember. What else did we do? Probably some things, but I can't remember.
Did you have like curfews or did you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And they had, it wasn't a room mother, it was a woman who stayed there at night because, you had to be in at a certain time if you went out on a date. But, you know, just kinds of crazy things. I remember asking somebody if they could cut hair because I needed a haircut. And one of the girls said, I can do that. Well, I found out later she had never cut hair. But she cut my hair, and it was so short, I couldn't keep my cap on. I mean, it was like, oh, no, that's long. This was really short. It's shorted. I couldn't keep my cap on. I mean, it was like, how am I going to keep my cap on? I had to pin it down, and, you know, many, many times. I thought I'd have to use tape after a while, but we finally got it on. But it was good education. And, of course, the hospital was right next door, so we could work besides just going to classes. You did that in a diploma program. You did a lot more clinical experience. It was a three-year.
What did you like about the experience there?
I loved helping to take care of people. Hmm. Actually, as a result of that, I didn't finish in the diploma program. I went into the Religious Order of the Sisters of Mercy that were at that school. Now, at this time, I'll just give you a little backtrack. I had my second mom's two sisters were Sisters of St. Joseph. And my older sister, she says she always, now we'll put this on tape, Marilyn at 16 left high school and became a Sister of St. Joseph. And everybody says, well, you know, they weren't surprised that Marilyn did, but everybody said to me, well, I guess you're next. And I used to say, no way, I wasn't. When I announced to the world and my parents that I was going into the convent, nobody could believe it because they go, no, not you, you know. So I did. What would have been my second year in the diploma program in School of Nursing, I went into the convent, which was in St. Louis. It was in St. Louis County. And
why did you decide to do it?
I really felt I had a religious call at the time. And then I thought, I really admired and high esteemed the religious that were at the Hospital School of Nursing. And combining the caring of people with that, and maybe hoping someday that I could also become a teacher. I was born a teacher. When I used to play school as a kid, and we had these great big chalkboards, and I had an American flag in my class, and don't ask me why, but it must have been the war, because I had this big picture of Douglas MacArthur, who was my hero, in my classroom, and I would only play school if I got to be teacher, and make everybody else do what they were supposed to do. So I think combining all these things, and I really felt I had a religious call. So I did that, and it was very interesting because there were several of us, one who was a nurse already, and three of us who had started 1 year of nursing program, one from the program I was in and one from Springfield, Missouri. And they let us continue our education, which was most unusual during the formative years in the convent. And so we went and picked up some of our courses, at Maryville, some of our sciences, and we even got to drive there, and that was most unusual. And then there were some that were in the same program, but they were from another community up north somewhere, and they came to our mother house, and we used to tootle down to St. Louis University School of Nursing, and there were five of us in the program. So I finished at St. Louis University with my bachelor's degree, even though I started in a diploma program.
What was it like? What did you do in your, not for your bachelor's, but in the religious order? What was that like?
Probably everything you would think of. School, we continued school. We had a junior college there. Even though we had the long habit on at the time, and I mean the old-fashioned long habit, we played basketball and softball. To this day, people go, how'd you do that? And I go, it's real simple. You pin them up, and you put them around, and you pin them back, and you play softball. We had swimming, we worked in the laundry, we had prayer time, we had meditation time, which I'm not a morning person, but it was at 5:30 in the morning. You could hear a lot of snores in the chapel, I must admit. But it was a beautiful place, it still is a beautiful place in St. Louis County. But it was a study time, prayer time. We all had a rotation through the kitchen because there were about 250 of all levels, those that were just starting, with some of the older sisters who had retired, and those all the way through different stages. Those who were teachers. It was both a nursing and a teaching order, and had some schools of nursing. So there were teachers in that program. So it was pretty normal. I thought it was very normal. When I finished the When I finished with my bachelor's degree, I was assigned to the hospital in Springfield, Missouri. Stayed there for a year, and then I came up and taught for 2 years at the diploma program in St. Louis, which had moved out to the new hospital. And I love teaching. I just absolutely love teaching.
Now, what year are we talking about approximately? Where are we at?
59 to 69.
Okay. 59 to 69 is when you're doing.
So if you ask me a lot about what happened during those periods in the world, I may not be as...
Well, let's talk about one of them.
Like the Beatles. It's like, I don't remember when they started.
How about John F. Kennedy? He might have remembered that.
The reason I know that, I was on campus at St. Louis University at the time. One of my philosophy classes was down on the main campus when we got the news. And I remember there was a group of us, and we all went to DeBerg Chapel. It was just felt like the right thing to do when we heard that. Yeah, so I do remember that.
Do you remember how you felt about it, though?
I was shocked. I was totally shocked, and to think that that could happen in our country. And, of course, Kennedy was the first Catholic president, and it was such a precedent, so... just unbelievable. And I mean, we watched television, depending upon what was on, but remember we all came back to the mother house at night and continued to watch television. It was such a shock. And I remember, I mean, the things like the first walk on the moon, I was coming back from Louisiana, we had houses in Louisiana, back to Vicksburg, Mississippi, where I was when you're, and I'll never forget, I was in Tupelo, Mississippi. One of the sisters I was with, her family was there when they walked on the moon. So, but a lot of the social things like Beatles and all that, I really wasn't involved with at all.
We had the flower power and the counterculture.
Missed it all.
You know, the...
Yeah, didn't do any of those things, obviously.
We're the drug culture, I guess is the word I was looking for there.
I think people must think I'm very naive because a lot of those things just don't mesh into, and then I think, okay, what year are they talking about? Oh, okay, that was 66 and 67. And I was really involved with a whole lot of other things, like the teaching and that.
Right. You know. Well, I do want to ask you a little bit political, in that in this period of time, there's a kind of the Cold War, even before John F. Kennedy was assassinated, you know, we had the U-2 crisis, and we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, and things like that. And the idea of nuclear holocaust. Was that anything?
Somehow or another, I think I was so involved with studies, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I had to know it was going on, mm-hmm. but did I take a stand? And you know, I don't think I had a lot of time to do that. That's a terrible thing to say. But even the Vietnam crisis, it's... I have a terrible memory, first of all. I have one of those memories that's global, and I don't have detail. I mean, even to this day, it's like, okay, where were we? Which army place did we go? Yeah, or my sister.
And Tell me what we did.
I used to feel really bad about that, but I don't have detail. My younger sister is very detail-oriented. She can tell you what I wore graduating from high school. You know, it was like... that kind of thing. I don't have that kind of memory.
I'm going to pause this just 1 second. No, you remember that? No. Okay. Okay, we're starting back up. We're going to have a slight little...
Intermission,
yes. We had an intermission. Okay, so you're in your teaching. What kind of teaching are you doing?
Nursing.
Okay. What? And so you're teaching, like, nursing...
Students? Right.
How did you enjoy that?
Oh, I loved it. 66 to 68. I love teaching. Most of my nursing career has been teaching. And some administration, but I just love to help. I mean, when the light bulb goes on and a student has learned how to give an injection, or you know, they're so proud that they gave their first bed bath. I've had something like 35 years of teaching.
Well, talk to me. Let's look at the perspective of when you started out here in the 60s teaching, and how it changed over time. You want, even though we're going to kind of jump forward in that, do you see some of that? The change that went on, either technologically, type of the level of skill, things like that. Anything you want to add?
Oh yeah, and well, we closed our diploma program in '68. That was the last year, and then I only had one more year in the convent, and I worked in nursing education in a hospital, but it was still education. It wasn't with students just becoming nurses, But, oh, I mean, everything has changed. And it changes so fast today. The technology, I can go visit somebody in the hospital and go, man, am I glad I'm not teaching now with all the bells and whistles and blah, blah, blah. Sometimes you wonder if people don't forget that there's a human being attached to all the bells and whistles. And how much more we expect students to learn. And it's like the fast changeover. I mean, it's like healthcare changes every 10 years, they say. You know, American history is American history. And it's probably not, it's changing as we change right now, but what was down in 18 blah, blah, blah is still pretty much the same. But, oh, and what we expect students to learn and the textbooks that they have to buy, it's just a whole different world. But it's still that laying on of hands that's exciting. And students that want to come in and learn that, it's very exciting.
So that part hasn't changed so much. The glistening in the eye and sparkle.
On the undergraduate level. Yeah. Now, you know, we never had. We had the graduate level. We didn't have the PhD level till later.
Okay, so we'll go back to the 60s. So it's 68, and so you're...
My last place was Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Okay.
I was assigned to the hospital down there and did nursing education. And that's when I really came with grips of... I was 29, and even though I had final vows, I had questioned whether or not I should do this the rest of my life, or should I get married and have kids. And
did you take your final vows?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay, you had. Okay.
65 or 66. Okay. And so I came to the realization that I needed to ask for a dispensation and take time out for a year. I had to go through the Pope and get permission to do this, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I did. I took a year off. Talk about my dad crying. My dad cried when I went in because he thought he was losing, and my dad was so proud of me, he cried when I came out. You know, I was like, it's okay, Dad. And so I came out at Sisters of Mercy in 1969. My sister by that time had come out of the Sisters of St. Joseph, and she came out really bitter.
Why?
Her life experience was entirely different from mine. Mine was wonderful. I would not have traded those 10 years of my life for anything. It was probably the best 10 years of my life insofar as formation for me. I mean, I came out and a lot of my friends still from high school, I mean, married with a couple of kids, some were already divorced. I had spent a lot of time on learning me and who I was and where I was going in life at 29. But a lot of things I didn't know. And I knew if I stayed in St. Louis, my parents might overprotect me. So I purposely wrote to hospitals and schools of nursing on the East Coast in Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. And I remember my mom didn't drive, but she came with me as I came for interviews. And my first interview was at Walter Reed, and all they wanted to do was sign me up for the Army, and I thought, I'm on a leave of absence from another commitment for 10 years. I don't want to join the Army. And didn't hear from NIH. And then I had an appointment over at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that sounds interesting. And I never will forget, I walked in the front door of the old entrance at Johns Hopkins. And there's that humongous statue of Christ. Have you ever seen it? And I thought, holy cow, this is it. This is where I want to work. And so I did. Stayed in the dorm until I could get an apartment. Mom, we flew her back home. And I lived in Baltimore for almost a year. Actually, it wasn't even a year. Two of my new friends then, one worked with me. I was in surgical ICU in the recovery room because they were combined. Hopkins was, at that time, building new units, but they were combined at that time. And so one of my friends worked there, and she had a roommate who worked in OBGYN. And so we became really good friends. And in fact, Ellen, my friend, is still a friend today. She and her husband and two kids. Ellen, it was the era of miniskirts. Now, I had been wearing long skirts, and then we had shortened them to knee level, but I certainly never worn a miniskirt. Ellen took me out the first time to buy a miniskirt, and I thought, Ellen, I cannot walk out in the street with this thing. She insisted I had to have miniskirts like everybody else.
Did you get some?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Did you wear them?
Yes, I did.
There you go.
Yes, I did. And the two of them were applying for a grant. I love Baltimore. It reminded me of St. Louis. I love the people I worked with, and I loved working in the ICU, even though I felt like it was a very antiquated unit compared to my very modern hospital in St. Louis. But they were applying for a U.S. Public Health Service grant to go to graduate school. And I thought, my God, they're both younger than me. They haven't had the experience I've had. I said, okay, where do I apply? So I applied, and Margaret, Ellen's roommate, got it, and I got it, and Ellen didn't. So Margaret and I went tripping off to Emory University, where I got a master's degree in a year.
Where's Emory at?
Atlanta, Georgia. Loved Atlanta, Georgia. I don't think I've lived anywhere I haven't loved. I think that's me. Had the opportunity of getting a faculty position there. Dean offered me one. I also went to Vanderbilt to interview, but I thought, I could go back to St. Louis University. So back to St. Louis University, I went after my master's degree and taught at St. Louis University.
So what year are we at now?
I got my master's degree in August of 71.
Okay.
Went back to teach there, and it was fine, but it's like, okay, I miss the East Coast. You know, Mississippi doesn't qualify as an ocean, and Ocean City, Maryland was wonderful. They also didn't have any mountains in St. Louis very much. So, and it was very interesting. There were five of us that were really good friends in the graduate program, and we all said, if anybody goes skiing, because I had gone skiing a couple times in Baltimore, then we should let each other know. And somewhere in the fall, I was teaching at St. Louis University, living in an apartment in St. Louis. Nice to be back around family. My friend Barbara had come back here to teach at UNC Chapel Hill. She called me and she said, "Do you still want to go skiing?" I go, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, there's a group of the faculty going skiing, and they've consented to let one more person come." And I didn't know at the time they took a vote, and some didn't want an outsider to come. And Ami and Barbara were saying, "Well," yeah. Ami said, "You know, if she's a friend of Barbara, she must be an okay person." So I came skiing, and I came to this little town called Chapel Hill. Well, remember, I lived in St. Louis, Baltimore, and Atlanta. Big cities. Flew in December of 1971, flew into this itty-bitty airport in Chapel Hill, which at that time was outdoors, and you had to walk from the plane indoors. And you always told people if you're going to the airport to go down this road, and where the donkey or the horse was, you took a right. And it was the smallest little place I'd ever seen. The town at the time was 50,000 people. We had to cook a turkey because Barbara was supposed to bring a turkey, and she stopped to get a hamburger for us at a place called Hardee's. I had never heard of a Hardee's. And so off the next day, we drove up to the mountains where we were supposed to go skiing, and there was about 8 or 9 of us, I guess. And there was no snow. So it was New Year's Eve. We had a nice New Year's Eve dinner. We waited for the midnight. But there wasn't enough snow to go skiing. And they were very nice people. Of course, I knew Barbara, and she was the only one I knew. I didn't know at the time that Ami was on the recruiting committee and was told by the dean she had to find a medical surgical nursing person, over the holidays because they were short. My area is medical surgical nursing. And I mean to tell you, the 8 of them threw out this, "Well, why don't you come teach here?" And I'm going, "Wait a minute. Chapel Hill has 50,000 people. There was no mall. There was no university mall." I was going, "This is small town USA." I had no idea who the Tar Heels were. Never heard of a Tar Heel in my life. Catholics were 3%. I'm going, "Barbara, there aren't any Catholics in here." I mean, it's like 3% of the population of North Carolina was Catholic at the time. You got to be kidding. But there was something intriguing about the nice people that I met, that they wanted me to move here. It was back on the East Coast again. There was water and mountains. And I said, "Well, I don't think I really want to move in." So they said, "Well, the dean," and they went back and told the dean that she thought they had somebody, and that if she thought if the dean sent her a letter just to interview, that I would come out to interview. I came in March to interview, and I moved here in August of 72. Now, at St. Louis University, I'll tie you into the military. At St. Louis University, one of my faculty colleagues was in the Air Force, and she was an Air Force Reserve. And she would go over to Scott Air Force Base, right across the river, 30 minutes, Scott Air Force Base, and do their weekend drills. And she kept saying, "Why don't you join the Air Force?" I'm going, "I don't want another commitment. Don't want any military commitment. Thank you, but no thank you." She tried two or three times really hard. So I came to Chapel Hill. Barbara, my best friend, was in this reserve unit, the 3274th. Ami, who I got to know as one of my course coordinators and had been skiing, was in this 3274th. Many of the people that I met in the mountains and people that I knew in the faculty all belonged to the same reserve unit. So on weekends, it was kind of quiet around. And somebody said to me, why don't you come down for one of our parties? And I can do that. Remember, I love parties. I went down to their parties, and I'm going, oh, this is a wonderful party. I'm going, what do you guys do on the weekend? Well, they took over Womack Army Hospital. They were nurses just like we were in real life. Some were teaching. The dental group did what dentists do. The doctors do what doctors do. Nurses and enlisted did nursing stuff. I thought, huh, and you get paid for this. Uh-huh, I thought, I could do this, and I could attend the parties at the same time. So,
which was the greater lure?
I'll never answer that question. I don't think I'll answer that. No, I really did feel at that time, I did feel a commitment to doing something for the country. You know, when people say that and go, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But I really did feel that. I thought, this is nothing different than what I do in civilian. Did I ever really think about the possibility of being activated? No. I mean, it was going down to Fort Bragg. I lived here. It wasn't that far away. It was a nice weekend, and I got paid for it. Did I ever think I'd be in for 23 years? Not on your life. Did I know anything about it? And I was brought in, as many of them were, because I had a master's degree and lots of experience already. I was given the rank of captain. And I'll never forget the day I lifted my right hand and said, you know, I will. I do. Ami gave me the oath of office as the chief nurse. Barbara was my witness, but Barbara had helped me get dressed. I had no idea how to put on my uniform. I had no idea how to salute. And if you recall, Fort Bragg is the home of the 82nd Airborne. If you went outdoors, you could run into a line of 82nd Airborne coming this way, and they pretty soon had a hint that some of us were not active duty, and they would just love to salute. So you had to learn how to salute down there. It was a wonderful experience because it was on post. I love that piece of it. So I signed up in October of 72. Did many different career things at the 3274th. I loved it. Loved all the places where we went for our 2 weeks of annual training. I think one time a group of us were down at Fort Benning. And I remember some of the corpsmen and myself and another nurse were in the emergency room. And I remember the head nurse, it was a male, and the head nurse said to me, you guys really work. And he was so stunned, and I'm going, excuse me, what are we supposed to do? And he said, this was in the 70s. And he said, you don't understand. He said, we have reservists that come here from all over. And some, after they sign in, we rarely see them. We don't know where they are, but they aren't working. We were there for our 8 or 10 hour shift, and we were working. I mean, they just said we meshed right in with their active duty folks. But I loved it. There was something really neat about being in the military that I loved.
Can you put your finger on it at all?
Yeah, I think it was my Girl Scout career and my religious career. It was just you know, the Girl Scouts wear a uniform and they have structure and rules, and the religious wear a uniform and had structures and rules, and I fit right into the military with structures, rules, and a uniform. I just, you know, there was my American flag and my General Douglas MacArthur again. I don't know. My sister says, what are you doing? And I'm going, how can I join the Army?
Well, let's talk about that. What did your family think about that?
Well, they didn't understand what that meant. I think at first they thought it was active duty.
From a sister to a captain.
Yeah, but now you got a couple of years in between there.
A couple.
69 to 72 is three. I don't think anybody was surprised at anything in my life that I ever did. Therese is like, okay, Sandy's going to do this. You know, it's like, you're going to start your PhD? When? Now, I think I probably, you know, just people just let me roll with the punches, but it was like, yeah. No, I'm not going on active duty. No, I'm not committed to, you know. I don't know that we even had a 6-year commitment back then. I don't know that.
Well, I was thinking of the reaction when you wrote about wanting to join the Navy. You know, what?
I didn't
did you get
think
any
that way. I was very angry inside with my teacher for saying that. I thought that was very cruel. And the more I knew people in the military, like Barbara and Ami and some of the corpsmen and men and women that I met down at Fort Bragg. I thought that was really ugly of her to say. Yes, I think there were those who joined for social reasons only. Did I know a lot of men and women that were probably having extramarital affairs? Yes. Did I think highly of them doing that? No. But I figured if they were doing it there, they were probably doing it in their civilian life back at home. And she kind of indicated that that was the reason women would go into the military. Either to play around or that they were looking for another woman. I mean, her innuendos were, and I thought, that's not the reason most people I knew joined the military. And I thought it was rather small-minded of her, but I didn't know her background or where she came from with this. There were days I still thought I should have joined the Navy. They were always having fun, and I think I told you, they had an event, and they had wristwatches and caps and sweatshirts, and they are Navy always had good parties. Air Force always had wonderful barracks. I don't know if they had good parties. And the Army was pretty good, but... So I think, someone said to me, you can make your life what you want it, either in the military or in civilian life. And I knew what I wanted to do with my life, so I felt very comfortable with it. Had a wonderful 23-year career.
Well, and go ahead.
Side by side with my civilian career. I mean, it was heavy duty, time-wise. I remember a friend, we used to write a Christmas letter to save time saying the same thing to everybody. And I remember way back when telling some of our good friends kind of what we had done, civilian and military, during a year. And one of our good friends, who is now deceased and younger than we were, said, I get tired reading your Christmas letter. We were busy. And the higher you got in rank, the more responsibilities you had and the more commitment you had. Like the year I lived in Richmond, we commuted up to Rockville, Maryland. We would go up there on a Wednesday evening after work to a staff meeting. And we're talking 3 hours away, and then drive home at midnight, get up and go to work the next day. We were either really committed or crazy. I think I was committed, but there were people that go, don't you get tired? It's like, yeah, I guess we did, but I never thought about it. It was a wonderful career. I wouldn't undo anything in my life.
What was it about the military at that time for you that you think, besides the uniform and the structure, that kept you there?
I love being on post, where I started out at WOMAC. I got to be teaching again, some of the enlisted. Even some of the nurses were rather young nurses. So I might have been a head nurse on a unit, but there was another nurse with me. But I loved being around the active duty component. You just felt like you were really in without being really in.
So with the responsibility that you had in the reserve, you started out as a captain. Did you have anybody under you where you had to, like, discipline or,
do their evaluations.
Yeah. How was that?
It was the same thing I was doing in civilian life. I didn't see it any different? No. I mean, yes, you had to know the rules and the regulations and what they could and couldn't do, mm-hmm. but insofar as how they were nursing, how mm-hmm. they were behaving, how you knew to counsel somebody that you never tore them down, you hoped you were building them up. It was no different than I was doing on my civilian side. Mm-hmm. The teaching was the same. It may have been different courses, but there was still teaching. I remember a couple of years, last with the unit, I got to be in charge of the orientation program for the new people coming in, and you got to instill values and what this unit is all about and what we really do here, and had two corpsmen working with me, and it was just really wonderful. So I don't think I ever saw it as a juxtaposition to what I was doing in my my civilian life. They always seemed to go together.
Because you're teaching in both.
I'm teaching in both. I'm nursing in both.
You're wearing a uniform in both.
I had positions of responsibility, mm-hmm. and I was very comfortable with that. Of course, people say Leos are leaders, and we take over even if we're not supposed to, so I sometimes had to learn not to be the leader. Learned that too.
Well, how about the different cultures? Because we talked to Ami about this a little bit. You have the academic culture and then you have a military culture.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not the same.
Correct. There are similarities.
Similarities.
But
yeah.
Differences.
Mm-hmm.
The rank especially. I was always in organizations with rank. They may have been called different. It may have been a dean. Or it may have been a mother superior. But there were always...
a hierarchy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That wasn't anything new and different to me. And growing up Catholic, there was always lots of hierarchies. But I was always comfortable with hierarchies, even with respect of knowing that this person, but always comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things that we did because of the units we were in very easily rubbed shoulders, like, say, for example, with a couple of generals. And I was very comfortable. There were other people I know that wouldn't go up and talk with the generals. I talked to everybody, and I was very comfortable with it. But there's still that respect for the position, mm-hmm. and you know what to do with that. So like I say, but there was always a hierarchy somewhere
mm-hmm.
of what you did and you didn't do. You just had to learn all the rules.
And then
how to get around the rules. I taught the students that too.
Well, you taught them that too?
Well, yeah, like in nursing,
yeah.
I'll never forget. We did teach a course one time on how to bend the rules and how to get around the rules legally. As, for example, in the days, I don't know if they still do it, but in the days when you were discharged from a hospital, you had to go by wheelchair. And a lot of people, if they weren't in for something really heavy and they weren't really tired, they go, I can walk. No, you have to go by wheelchair. Well, we soon did this course that said you had to go by wheelchair. It didn't say you had to sit in the wheelchair. And so some of the nurses would discharge a person who really wanted to walk and they knew they could. They would roll the wheelchair alongside of them, but they would walk out. They complied with the law, but they bent the law.
And made the patient happier, too.
You got it.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, what about, okay, so this time period, in this time frame that you're in the military initially, there's, I know I keep going back to different things happening in the world and culture, but the women's movement. Did that have any impact on you at all? Influence?
You know, I really don't remember ever being put personally in what I thought was a second person category because I was a woman. Maybe I was too dumb to know it. That I should have been. There was one occasion. I will admit, when I was at Hopkins, I dated an intern who was Jewish. And I felt he always walked 3 feet ahead of me, and I thought that was very strange. And I was dumb enough to walk 3 feet behind him. That relationship didn't go anywhere, but and we soon broke it off when I went to graduate school, after I was there for a while. But I don't remember. We had a big discussion about this in the doctoral program, and one of my friends said, you know, she was really a feminist and said women were always oppressed. And I said, I don't remember ever being oppressed. And there was this discussion about women who played sports weren't as oppressed. I mean, I've been playing sports since I was second grade. We were competitive. We were friends. I truly don't remember being oppressed because I was a woman. Maybe one or two times felt that somebody was womanizing me of, you know...
You know what I mean?
Wanting more than just a friendship relationship, and he was a married man, and I didn't like that. Or you felt somebody was mentally undressing you while they were staring at you. And it's an innate, uncomfortable position. But I don't remember ever feeling like I couldn't do something because I was a woman. And laughing at it, not laughing, but it's like, what do you mean she can't be in that position because she's a woman? I mean, that's so stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Why we can't have a woman president? Duh! I mean, we've had women presidents of universities, etc., big organizations, etc., etc. It's like, that's so crazy. And that will come someday.
Mm. Well, did you have a favorite place that you got to go? You have a nice list here, I see.
Oh.
That when you went on your 2 weeks during the summer. I'm assuming during the summer sometimes. I don't know.
Sometimes it was during the year, but mm-hmm. that was hard because of our situation on the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
A favorite place?
Here's the ones you're
going to go. I loved wherever it was on a post.
Yeah. Why would you keep me saying that? What was it about the post that you liked?
You just felt like, I mean, like being a
Womack. Like being a part of it, maybe?
Yeah, Womack. Oh, and at Walter Reed, you had all the history that went with Walter Reed. And, of course, probably Ami told you about my 8 months, her 9 months stay at Walter Reed during Desert Storm.
Why don't you tell me about your part there?
I started the doctoral program in 86 at Virginia Commonwealth University. Finished coursework in 2 years. Took off of life because I was ready, you know, thinking I got to get this finished. And I wanted to be on the faculty, so I did full-time coursework. Bit the nail, did it, also got a traineeship. Been spoiled rotten by God in my life. I never paid for my bachelor's, master's, or PhD. And I, you know, returning back to all the good that's been given to me. But anyway, finished coursework, did the work for the comprehensive exam, did that, and started part-time work, which was probably wrong because I just kind of didn't chip away at the dissertation that much. And I was doing a heavy-duty research project. You know, keep it simple. Well, I wasn't keeping it simple, Sandy. I was really making it complicated. My advisor kept saying, you know, we could cut out some of this. Okay. And I was just to the third year thinking, I'm going to get it done this year. And because we were in a command unit, we had 16 units under us. And we gradually saw our units and some of our friends that we knew back here in North Carolina being called to active duty for Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And we went to say goodbye to one of our units out of Richmond, and they were down at Fort Eustis, so we went down there Friday and said goodbye to all of them with hugs and kisses and tears, and drove up to Walter Reed because I was supposed to have my physical Saturday morning, my annual physical. And we got there, and unbeknownst to me, Ami said something to somebody about, well, you have to have your shots, and Ami says, no, we don't need them now. And she said, yes, you do, ma'am. We didn't know because we didn't go back home. We had gotten the call Friday night that we were being put on active duty. And she told them, don't tell Sandy till she's finished with her physical because her blood pressure will go sky high. So they told me afterwards, and my blood pressure, I think, bottomed out. I don't think I had one after that. It's like, okay, not now, God. No, this is the year I'm supposed to finish the thing. Well, we wound up going on active duty. But it probably made me very organized. I pulled together my research of what was coming. I had sent out a survey. I had to develop the instrument, had sent it out. I lined up people to get my mail. I lined up a young woman at the university to do my statistical input and had to clarify to her all the analysis that I wanted out of it. Had a friend who was going to relay it up to me at Walter Reed. So because of not being at home in Richmond, I had everything pretty well organized. And I remember in the beginning, there were 2,500 people that came to Walter Reed from the whole East Coast, Army Reserve and National Guard. They pulled everybody out and brought them to Walter Reed. And they put us up in hotels in the beginning. And I was late coming home. I worked in nursing education. We were retraining all of our corpsmen who hadn't been at a bedside in years to be back at a bedside in a crash courses. I mean, we were giving them heavy-duty crash courses of how to take care of patients. And so I took the bus back to the hotel, and everybody from that hotel was out in the street. And I finally caught up with them, and I'm going, what's going on? And she said, there's a bomb threat at the hotel. And my first comment was, did you bring my disc for my dissertation, as if it was the only important thing in the whole world. Did you bring my disc? And Ami went, no. And I was panicking that everything that I had was on those discs up in the room. Well, luckily they brought in the dogs and they couldn't find any evidence of a bomb. But I was like, oh, man. I continued to chip on the dissertation. I got my statistical analysis. I kept sending it back for more analysis. I went home on a couple of weekends and met with my advisor. And I went back in Army green uniform and defended my dissertation. I was so proud that day, I can't tell you. Even my foreword in my dissertation talks about the people that were in Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and how proud I was to be a part of that. So Walter Reed has a special place in my heart. It always did whenever we went up there.
I know your dissertation's sitting right here.
Yeah, it's holding up the microphone.
We had to raise it a little. Yeah. So.
I couldn't just throw that away. It's no. Like, I don't know what you do with it afterwards, but I couldn't throw it away.
But what was it that made you so proud?
Number one, that I think I completed it, and I knew it really well, and I knew that the faculty would ask some questions. I knew they had to, and I knew they also, a couple of them, would do it. But I was prepared for what I felt was any questions. And there was something about wearing my colonel uniform that gave me authority that day. I felt like whenever I was answering their questions, I was doing it with great knowledge, authority, and support of that uniform. I don't know what it was, but I was so proud to be there in my uniform.
Did you have to wear your uniform colonel?
I was on active duty. I felt I should.
Yeah.
They were paying me. I got permission to have a day off because the faculty obviously wasn't going to come in on a Saturday or a Sunday. And so I got permission. I was still on active duty. I just got permission to go to Richmond that day. Of course, everybody in my, you know, everybody knew, the chief nurse, everybody had signed off on it. They knew why I was going there. But, yeah, so I felt I needed to be in my green uniform.
Avi was talking about how you both had full-time jobs and you had years of the reserve every weekend, and sometimes more than every weekend. So he's talking 2 and 3 times.
Because of our responsibilities.
Right, because you're at such a high level in your field. And that when you got called to active duty, you kind of had a break in some ways.
Oh, yeah. We didn't have to just go on weekends. We were there Monday through Friday. Yeah, it was different. We had weekends off. It was really a switch. And that's how I had time. I didn't get to play as much on weekends in D.C. as I would have chosen to do. But there were other people that did a lot of fun things on weekends. Although the first couple of months, I think we even had Saturday classes, just in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then when we knew we were going to not be as involved as, thank God, we thought we were going to be. I mean, some of the people got to go home. Some of us were held back. I got to write and be on the team that wrote Lessons Learned for nursing at Walter Reed Army Medical Center.
What were some of the lessons?
That we had.
This is about Desert Storm. Right?
Yeah, but also the reservist. I mean, it was like, because we were reservist and because we were National Guard, and seeing what would have happened if we didn't have the time to train people. I mean, we had some of our corpsmen, especially National Guard, well, some of the reservists too, who were scared to death of the thought of being back at the bedside. But they had the medical occupation specialty, the MOS, mm-hmm. of being a corpsman. That's what they were supposed to be doing. But in their unit back at home, they were doing secretarial stuff. And to think of having to take care of patients and maybe critically ill patients. So that was one of the big, big ones. Can I remember anymore? But we did a really good document, I can tell you. I don't think I even have a copy of it anymore. But it went to not only the commander at Walter Reed, but it went higher echelons. Mm-hmm. But we also had a good time with some friends. I remember one time, one of our National Guard's friends, she had a husband and 2 kids, and they lived in Maine. And she would drive back at a drop of a hat. And she came back one time, and we said, why don't you bring some lobsters? So she brought 4 lobsters. There were 4 of us that were going to have lobsters. Well, then at dawn, we sat at our house. Well, she had brought back a big pot to boil them in. But we realized we didn't have any crackers, you know, to crack the cloth. So we all went and got hammers. We had hammers, like these little first, you know, toolbox kits. So we cracked. But it was fun, and we did have a good time. They put us in apartments. That's when we worried that we were going to be there for a while. And some selectively were there for a while. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you had to leave your house. I heard you had just bought a house.
Right? We had just finished. The house was finished in, actually it was August of 90. We were activated in January 91. Mm-hmm. And thank God, because of the reserves, we always had a house sitter who would stay at the house with the animals. And we had a wonderful young woman. She and her family were in our parish, so we knew them. Mm-hmm. And she was always there on weekends. She was an occupational therapy student. And we asked her if she'd consider staying there. And since I was on active duty 8 months and Ami was on 9 months, you know, and Ami would call, as she would drive down a couple weekends here or thither to pick up mail and things, bills. And I remember that she'd say, I just love living at your home. We'd go, stop it, Tina. You're there longer than we were. But it was good for the animals and for her.
Yeah.
It's funny. Yeah.
Was there anything in particular that you disliked about being in the reserve? Or on active duty when you...
I really can't say anything to that. There were some people I thought that didn't do their positions well enough. I kind of slurped it off, and, you know, I feel that, you know, if you've got something to do, do it well. But then I realize that that's some of my values. There were some people that you thought, okay, that's just that person. And they weren't under nursing. They weren't under my, if I was the head nurse or something. So I really didn't have that responsibility, but sometimes you could kind of just, I mean, if they were peers or colleagues, you could say something mm-hmm. quietly off the cuff, like, you know, is that the best you can do? No. Would I do it all over again? Absolutely. Every moment of my life. I can't think of anything I would change.
Well, when you look back, you talked a little bit, we talked about changes in the nursing field. Did you see changes in the military over this 23-year mm-hmm. period? What kind of changes do you recall?
Women got promoted more, like, for example, the Chief of the Army Nurse Corps. That position has changed. I mean, it was a one-star general, and now it's a two-star, and they head up a command. I mean, they can head up, like, a base. In the reserves, we at one time never had a Chief of the Army Nurse Corps Reserve, and then we did get one, and then that one got a position as a general. So a lot of positive things, I think, changed for women.
What do you think helped those changes come about?
I think there were a lot of people who recognized that, thank God, women were as capable. I'm sure somewhat the women's movement did that. But I think there were some very astute males who recognized that the women were just as capable. I think there were those that maybe drug their feet, but I think there were those that recognized that the women could hold positions of command and do it just as well, if not in some situations, maybe better.
We talked at lunch a little bit about networking.
I used to love it. I mean, there was people, because we moved, I mean, I moved so much with places geographically for civilian, and then because of civilian of military, and then because of military and civilian, we knew people in a lot of places. It was fun when we went to some of the military medical meetings that we'd run into people from all these units that we knew. And I was like, how do you know so many people? I was like, been around. And that was always fun, because you could call somebody and, you know, do you know blah, 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 or network with people, both civilian and military. And hooked up people because they had similarities, like, but let's say, for example, maybe somebody specialized in infectious diseases in civilian. Well, you know so-and-so who does this in the military? No. Well, could you give me her name? I love doing that in life. I still do that with people that I meet that are new. It's like, oh, okay, well, you must know so-and-so. Well, you should know so-and-so if you don't. Who is it? Was it the Dalai Lama that says we're only 7 degrees removed from knowing everyone in the world? I'm working on it. Who do you know that I don't know?
I don't know. We'll have to figure that out.
We had one of our darling guys at the unit up in Rockville, Maryland. He is just such a love. We ran into him in an airport not too long ago. We're all in civvies, but we ran into each other. And he worked public health at Hopkins. And because of his position, he was a great researcher also, doing a lot in public health. He and a team were going over to India, and he stood about yay tall, I mean, 6 foot something, and he had the opportunity with the team to meet Mother Teresa. So I figured now I'm only 2 degrees removed from knowing Mother Teresa.
That's pretty special. I see a little baggie down here with
medals, pictures.
Yeah.
The way those came from, why they're in a bag, is because at Carroll Woods we had a day, it was Veterans Day. When I came, when we came here for our interview, and we had one of the interviews was with the CEO. And so I said,
at Carroll Woods.
Carroll Woods. Okay. And we were having this interview, and Ami and I happened to know her from a previous. But I said, now, what does this, it was, you know, coming up to October, and it's Veterans Day, and I said, Well, with 460 people here, I am sure there are a fair number of veterans. So what does Carol Woods do for Veterans Day? She said, actually, we haven't done any. And I said, what? So, I mean, I put together this proposal, which we took to the Resident Council, Association Council, and we presented why we thought we should do something on Veterans Day. I mean, there isn't anybody I know that doesn't do something for people that have been veterans. So that year, they at least asked all the veterans or the spouses of the veterans who were in the meeting to please stand and be recognized for a moment of silence. And it was really nice. And then this year, they have two big display cases in the main building. And so they asked all, anybody that was associated with military, to either submit a photo or some memorabilia or some awards. And so we had a nice variety of photos, and we did our medals. It was really very nice. So we'll keep hounding them every year to do something.
Is there any medal or award or anything that you received that you're particularly proud of?
All of them, each and every one. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I would say one more than other. I just don't toot my own horn about a lot of things.
What
like
do you
that.
Have in there? Oh, you already... I'm going to pull this up. Okay, I'm going to go again.
Okay,
so we got the...
I'm not a big one about medals and awards and tooting my horn, but this is the Army Commendation Medal, and I got that several times, you know, with the Oakley cluster and that. Mm-hmm. And my meritorious service, that was kind of like a culmination of my military career.
And then you have a cute picture, you and Ami there. Mm-hmm. What are you wearing in that picture?
These are our BDUs, the battle dress uniform, which they don't wear the same one today.
Nope.
And I'm also very glad. When I was a kid, I have pictures of my older sister and myself wearing tams. And for some reason, I didn't like a tam. And if I was in the Army today, I'd have to wear that maroon tam. And I would not be happy camper. So I'm glad I retired in 95.
Is that the hat?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, God, I would have died.
Yeah. But that's a cute picture.
This is a cute picture. The question is...
Where are you and what year is it?
Yeah, because I'm trying to look at rank. I think we were at Fort Leonard Wood. That unit did not do, you know...
It's one of your 2 week, probably, right?
We always lived away from our place, except the 3.5 years in St. Louis with the 21st General. We would go 15 minutes to our headquarters. But then, because the hospitals were at a distance, I, as assistant chief nurse, would travel to the hospitals. But when we did some other drills, we went for weekends down at Fort Leonard Wood. Well, most of the people in this unit had never done that. They went, we have to be away from home for the weekend? It's like, yeah. They thought it was the hardest thing in their lives. Now, granted, some were mothers and fathers, but, you know, I grew up tripping down to Womack and staying down at Womack at the bachelor officer's quarter. The year we lived in sea level, it was a 4-hour drive to Womack, stay all weekend, and drive home for 4 hours. I mean, that was what you had to do.
You didn't think twice about it.
No, but these people thought it was the hardest thing, but then they got away and they found out they had lots of fun in the evenings also because they weren't working all the time. But I think this must have been Leonard Wood.
Yeah.
We did several things like this, so I wouldn't put my hand on a
Bible. Right,
sure,
and over 23 years probably to pinpoint it. Yeah. Did we see the rank on the...
No, I can't see that.
It's hard to see on that outfit. Well, we'll figure that out. It's usually on your helmet, or do they not do that? Do they do that...
Oh, no.
Black now.
No, well, I don't know what they do now, but I have it on, it says subdued, you know, the produces.
Yeah.
You can't see it because it's black.
Right, then you certainly can't. Well, what,
if it's after 86, I think my date of rank for colonel was 86.
Yeah.
So if I'm a colonel, it's after 86, which means it would have been the unit up at 2290th. And we did field things,
Well, you were a Girl Scout, that was no problem, right?
No, and I still like tenting. I still like camping. Okay.
Well, what do you have to tell? Well, first of all, why did you decide to retire when you did?
I felt 23 years. You know, there's this magical number if you go over something. I would have had to stay I don't know how many more years. But I was very involved with civilian life at the time between... teaching, my position at the university, my church in Richmond, and I just really think I just felt it was the right thing to do at the right time. The same thing like when I retired from the university. It was the right thing to do at the right time. had been a wonderful career, but I felt it was time.
Do you have anything that you would say to people that might be interested, especially women that might want to consider the military for a career, either through the reserve or otherwise?
Reserve or active duty, I think it's a wonderful second career. If it's active duty, I think it's a wonderful opportunity. I think there's educational opportunities. I think there's travel opportunities. I think there's growth. I'll never forget, Ami's nephew was dating this young woman who went into the Army. And she didn't like to take orders. And they had to put, you know, their footlocker, they had to put their things in this kind of an order. They gave them exactly. Well, she didn't do it. You know, it's kind of like a young teenager, but she was like a 20-year-old something. But she didn't do it exactly that way, so she had to run a couple of laps. And the next time inspection comes, she hadn't done it right, so she did a couple of laps again. And I remember her writing back to Jonathan in their letter saying, you know, about the fifth time I had to do laps, I finally put it together. If I would only do it that way, I probably wouldn't have to do all these extra laps. So I think there's a growth, especially for young people. I never, ever knew how well I was going, how much I was going to really, really like the retirement check as a part of my now income. I never knew that TRICARE for Life was going to be such a good secondary health insurance. Do I know what the future is when people are talking about what people on active duty or reserves should get in the future? I don't know if they're going to have the same blessings and opportunities. But I think just being involved itself with the military is a wonderful opportunity. I've heard of, I know people who came out of the reserves and absolutely hated their career in the reserves or active duty. And I still say, no different than the convent, if you come out bitter or you had a great time, it's kind of what you make life. And a lot of it is, you know, yeah, there are things that you have to do and you may not like it, but that's life too.
Mm-hmm. What about the role that women play now in the military?
Good. I think we should do more of it.
Like what?
Chief of staff. And I don't mean chief of staff. Joint chiefs of staff is what I meant. I don't think they have a woman there yet.
No, they have not.
No. And I think that day is coming. I mean, we've got them on the Supreme Court. Why not? We just haven't got somebody to that position yet. It will come.
What about in the combat role?
I think to a point. I just don't think we're quite as physical as the men. And maybe that's just me. I wouldn't want to be on the front lines. A little bit further back, I would do some things. But today, even further back, it's dangerous.
Flying a jet plane?
It's dangerous.
Driving a tank?
Yeah. And, you know, we're great drivers. I don't know why we can't drive a tank.
And well, I don't know. I heard about Omni driving the tank.
Let's see. She had this little slot. It was a Humvee.
Okay.
Was it a Humvee? No, it wasn't. It was a tank.
But she
it
said
only
it was
had
a
this
tank,
little
yeah.
slot to look out of, and I'm going, oh, my God, she's going to hit a tree. I guess when the thing I would have the hardest with is hand-to-hand combat.
Mm. The physical
yeah.
aspect of it.
And yet I'll bet you there are women who know karate that are probably fine in that position. I think it's all individual. Maybe give the person a choice. I don't know. If I had a daughter, would I be more worried if she was on the front lines? Yeah, probably. But I think we can do almost any position very well. And like you say, they're in the jets, they're in the whatevers. And I think they have a right to be and should be. Although I remember one time we were both stunned when we got on a commercial airline and there was a woman pilot and it was kind of like, oh. I remember I'm thinking, you think she knows what she's supposed to do? I'm like, yeah, I think so. But it's kind of a shock then the first time you do it. That was years ago.
Yeah. Well, is there anything that you'd like to say to anyone to add? Because we've talked a lot about over the last 23 years that we haven't talked about.
I can't think of anything. When you leave, I'll think of lots of things. And I don't think it's just the nursing part that has been wonderful. I mean, I had friends who were not nurses in the military. So I don't want people to think it's just because I was a nurse that the nursing part was great. We had lots of, even in our reserve units, females who were in different service of, you know, doing different things. And they were doing it very well.
Lots of different roles or
oh, yeah.
jobs that they had.
And commanders today. Mm-hmm. It's, yeah. All that, thank God, has changed. I think people need to explore it, and I don't know if there's ways to explore it.
Without that commitment, you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And maybe somebody should think about that for recruiting.
Well, you beat the 10 years with the...
Yes, I did. Should I add them together and count 33?
I think maybe you can, yeah.
Never thought about that. I remember, and then we spoke up years afterwards, when I came in or when Ami came in, and a lot of us came in, we didn't go to a basic course, which is why I didn't know how to salute and do a lot of things. We spoke up enough about that needed to be changed so that now most reservists have to do a basic. And I think that's a good thing.
Did you end up going through it? Mm-mm. Because Ami said she...
We had a basic course. It was a paper-pencil learning course, but it wasn't out in the field, blah,
right.
blah, blah. That came later for the reservists. And they may not appreciate that we spoke up, but we felt it was only right. I mean, I was good in nursing. I was good in, you know, saying similar things in my civilian position. It was the military part of me.
Walking on Fort Bragg and having...
Yeah, and there I came in as a captain and should know something.
Yeah.
But I will learn, and I did learn, and I learned what I had to learn, and that's what I've always told the students in nursing. You may not know everything, but you know a smart person knows where to find the answers. So, they did. And it's just been, I think it's so wonderful. I do wish there were a way for people to have a taste of it without having to commit. They used to do that in schools of nursing because there was a time when, like, juniors and seniors in the school of nursing could, how'd that go? They could be commissioned, and while they were students, they were getting paid and that kind of a program. And then some of them did do some time, like a week or something somewhere. I think that's a taste of something. And I know they used to bring some students down for recruiting purposes. They threw them down to some post or some place. I think those are good opportunities. It's like no different than in civilian life today where they have, you know, mothers take a daughter to work to see what your daughter sees you, what you're really doing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think most people have a clue as to what people really do. Why would you do that? Because it was wonderful. And if needed, I would go. Of course, the day they told me I was really going on active duty, besides the dissertation, I assumed I was going to the desert. We did not know we were going to be kept at Walter Reed.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like a first grader, Therese, leaving Richmond. I remember telling people in our church, we're going on active duty. We don't know where we're going. We don't know how long we're going to be going. We don't have a forwarding address or telephone number. And people go, well, how can you go? I'm going. And that's, you know, what I signed up years ago for. And I was a little scared. I really, I remember telling my mom and dad, who were alive at the time, and I called when we pretty much had the clue, we got put up at the hotels, that most of us, because our reserve unit at that time's mission was Walter Reed. And Walter Reed was designated as the first stop back in the United States for any injured. And I remember telling my dad, well, we're not going to the desert, thinking he was going to be really relieved, but we're going to stay in Washington, D.C. And he said, that's about as dangerous as the desert in Washington, D.C. No, we'll be okay, Dad. As you heard the sirens and the police cars a lot in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
So, are we finished?
Well, do you have anything else you'd like to add that you don't think... I think I want to bring in Ami and ask you guys a couple things together. Can
sure.
we do that? So
sure.
we'll pause it for now, and I want to thank you first, though.
You are very welcome. It's been
okay.
fun.
Right.
Are we going to get a copy of this?
Okay, we have one... this is an amendment, I guess, to Sandy and to Ami's oral history, since they shared... you've shared all your time in the
yeah.
military together, and
yes.
you had 6 years on her.
Yeah.
You got her beat by 6 years.
Yeah.
So I'd like you guys to tell me about how you met and how, you know, how you all got together and went these places, and just tell me what how that dynamic kind of
came. Oh, that was love. I told her about Barbara.
Barbara
came skiing. This whole group gave me the recruiting pitch to come teach at UNC Chapel Hill.
Right.
And Ami was on the recruiting committee, and especially looking for a med-surg faculty member. And, of course, I'm a med-surg faculty teaching at St. Louis University at
I'm
the time.
I'm going to move this mic for a second, because I know I can hear you loud and clear. Yeah.
And I told her I'm also...
There we go.
I told her also about how I didn't think I wanted to move this small town. I didn't know what a Tar Heel was. Or 50,000 people was a small Hoboken town to me.
Yeah,
I was from big cities. But you convinced the dean to send a letter, and she sent a letter.
I was told by the dean I had to find a faculty member.
So, lo and behold.
So you were the guinea pig.
I was it. And I came down, and I really got impressed with Chapel Hill. And now, after I left Chapel Hill.
She wanted to come back.
4 years later, I couldn't wait to get back to Chapel Hill. The only reason I moved back from St. Louis to Richmond was because it was closer to the East Coast and Chapel Hill.
And the beaches.
And Carol Woods, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I had it all figured out. But it got to be funny because we have been in many of the same civilian positions and many of the same military positions. And some of our friends will laugh at us. In fact, our nickname with some of our good friends was Shirley and Laverne. Do you know Shirley and Laverne?
I think it's Laverne and Shirley.
Laverne and Shirley.
They the same.
They wouldn't tell us which was which, but they always figured it out.
Oh, Laverne. I think I know. I think I had that figured out myself. Very good.
But we did, I must admit, it has always been, whether it was civilian or military, a wonderful working collegial relationship of similar thoughts, ideas, what needed to be done, and then also the ability to have the contra of see this, Ami sees that, and we can mesh together those thoughts.
I think that was part of why some of the commanders wanted us together in the military. You be the chief, she be the assistant. I want you to do the same thing you did there, blah, blah, blah. So there was a lot of that.
To kind of have you together because it worked really well together like that.
Yeah, we were very fortunate that way because everybody who wanted to move with their friends didn't necessarily have that reputation.
Right.
So that part was very...
Well, even, you know, married couples that are in the military together, to get to move together is not easy. So that's one of the questions I was going to ask you. How were you able to...
That's the advantage of being civilian.
Yeah.
Because most people, civilian-wise, joined whatever unit is close in the reserves. And that's actually what we did, except when they married the last time, yeah.
Yeah.
She was sure when we left North Carolina that she wasn't going to find a position in St. Louis.
Well, that was that colonel position that you were looking for?
Yeah, they were getting scarce by the time we left here. Before that, you could go anywhere. You didn't need to have sauce. You could be extra excess. Didn't matter.
They could just stick you in somewhere?
Oh, yeah. You didn't have to have a slot that said colonel on it. You could sit in the captain's slot as a colonel.
Oh, and then they changed that.
Oh, yeah.
Huh. When did they do that?
I was still at Fort Bragg getting ready to go to St. Louis because that was the first time I experienced that.
So it would have been around the early 80s.
Yeah.
So was it sometimes that it was like the civilian lead and then the military kind of followed? And then was it ever like the military lead?
No,
and
I would
always
say
always the civilian?
Every move was civilian initiated.
Mm-hmm.
It just happened that the one in Richmond had a very strong
attachment. Well, yeah, because it was the same boss who talked me into...
Oh, that's right.
Who wanted me for both positions. So that's the only one that... It was both equally important.
Well, you both talked about how you've enjoyed pretty much everywhere you've been. I don't even pretty much. You've enjoyed everywhere you've been.
Yes.
But yet, here you are, back in the place you started, where you met, right?
Yeah.
Chapel Hill. And loving it.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I'm sure there are many reasons for that. As I told you, I think that we had so many friends here that we kept in touch with no matter where we moved. Either we would come here frequently and visit them. They would come to St. Louis. They came to Richmond a lot when we lived in Richmond because it was easy, 2.5 miles up and down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So we stayed very much in touch with Chapel Hill the whole time, no matter where we were, even when we were down at the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sandy was telling me about when you were talking about Veterans Day.
And
that they didn't have a program here at Veterans Day.
I couldn't believe that.
So I wanted to ask you both about your ideas of patriotism. What does that mean to you? And you became a citizen in 1960, right?
20th of May.
20th of May, 1960.
And but she also came from a country where every young person spent, 1 year? 2 years.
Even women as well?
Uh-uh.
Just men?
Some countries have women. Yeah. Sweden was only men.
Yeah. Okay. In fact, there's nothing, I mean, there's no nurse corps in the military in Sweden at all. Just a sort of like wax used to be.
Right. Yeah. But your father was, you know, pretty high up in the military there,
right.
So you had that tradition. And then,
very definitely.
Did you say your father was also in the military?
No, he got rejected because he had one hip lower than the other. They wouldn't take him. I had two uncles who were, but I don't remember them ever in uniform. Yeah. I must have been little at the time. But my dad couldn't serve.
But so what do you think about, like, now we're a country at war? And
I think patriotism has come back more than it was. Well, of course, we talked about Vietnam and how terrible it was at that point.
I think we learned some very hard lessons from that.
Yeah.
And it was nice to see with Desert Storm and Desert Shield.
I know. I said that, sure.
And I think today, regardless of what people think about the situation and the military situation, I think there is support of the individual troops and the people.
Whether they support the war.
That's right.
Yeah.
Big difference, you think?
Yes, that is a big difference, because a certain lot of people do not agree with the Iraq war or the Afghanistan war, but they do have more and support our troops for whatever reason.
I do have a terrible feeling, and I know it. I just have, anytime I see it, the group that makes a ruckus at funerals of military.
Make the what?
Make the ruckus at funerals of military, like somebody that was killed in Iraq that comes home and has a funeral and they make a thing. I admire the military that go, the retirees or whatever, that the veterans that go alongside with motorcycles.
And block them out.
I just cannot imagine somebody doing it. Just sheer courtesy at the time of someone's funeral. To make a stand that you're trying to get the nation and the higher bees to see, but you just don't do it out of common courtesy at a funeral.
It's plain politics at funeral.
Oh, I just think that's so ugly.
It is.
Well, now, I'm sitting in a room here. I'm a staff sergeant, and I have two colonels. And yet, you know, in the discussions we've had today, your pride about your service and wearing of the uniform just, you know, is very strong, comes through really strong. And I wonder when I talk about what you would like to tell people about the military, maybe a civilian doesn't really understand that connection. Is there anything that you've thought about since your interview ended a little while ago that you want to add to that?
I want to tell you one thing. We were at Fort Simmons, I'll never forget. We were at Fort Simmons, and we were doing something, and the unit always had a party towards the end of our 2 weeks 18. And I remember we were talking about something, there were a group of us, and there were a couple of sergeants there, and all of a sudden the sergeant said, "I can get whatever we were looking for." And I'm going, "How did you go to do that?" And he said, "Ma'am," very politely, he said, "Ma'am, the sergeant will get it, but never ask the sergeant how he will get it or where he will get it."
And I never did.
Thank God for the sergeants in the world. They know where to.
They could always do it.
It's my enlisted. They get me on my toes.
You just wanted to get it done, and we'll take it.
He came up with it, let me tell you.
You develop a respect and appreciation for so many people in different ranks, not just your rank or higher. Everybody, and this the enlisted guys and the sergeants, are the most important part of any military thing. And that's what makes it fun. They're what makes it for real. That your heart goes out to them more than anybody else. They work so darn hard, and they don't get as much as we do, who sit up there in a much higher position and don't do half the stuff that they do.
Well, what about just the simple part about the military environment, where you have so many people from so many different walks of life, from all over the country and, you know, all over the world, that you are learning about. How do you think that might influence a young person when they're in that kind of environment, instead of being from, like, you know, Podunksville, like me? I was from a little tiny town in Michigan. Pretty, you know,
Tell me what kind of a person you are. I mean, to me, it's that same thing. Life is what you're going to make it. Mm-hmm. And if it's somebody who wants to broaden their horizons and will take it as a positive opportunity, it's like, oh, I'll never forget the young woman we had in 2290th who was Muslim, and she wore the headdress. And there was this big ruckus of whether or not she could wear it with the uniform, etc. And I had to admit, I knew nothing about their rules and etc., etc. So for me, it was a learning curve. And I think if somebody looks at life opportunities like that, okay, what, you know, I've learned from different people.
What happened with that?
She was finally allowed to wear it at Walter Reed. Yes, she was.
She was?
Yes. There was a big to-do about it, and there were those who were saying no. And, I mean, that went through echelons of authorities, and she was allowed to wear it. I was very surprised.
Yeah, I couldn't remember how it ended.
Yeah. No, she was allowed to wear it.
She was. It was sort of towards the end of life.
Yeah. But, you know, and there's, you know, there's all kinds of things like that.
I mean, I did not disagree with her. Wearing it. On the other hand, I sort of felt a little bit like the military, that if you're in the military, you do what's military rules. I mean, I wouldn't go to a Muslim country and not do what they expected me to do. So I felt if you're going to be in the United States Army military, you really should try to do that. But if it was really that much against their religion, also, I had a bit of a conflict how I really felt about it. I couldn't imagine her not being in that outfit because it just wasn't her. And yet, I had a little hard time with that. I didn't have to take a stand on it, thank heaven, so it was okay.
not in your chain of command So
there's so many opportunities for learning and getting to know other people. The sergeant who taught me at our picnic at Fort Bragg, we had a roasted pig at our picnic, and he was so cute. They had permission to. They cooked it all night. And he said, "Come here, ma'am." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Do you know where the best part of this, you know, split open pig is?" And I go, "No." And he said, "Come here, I'll show you." So you learn from people. But if you're somebody who is not comfortable with people of different skin color or gender or blah, 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 whatever, the military is not going to be any different than civilian life. You're going to stay in your own little networking. And I think they'd have a hard time.
Your father would love that yellow. Yeah. What is that called?
You're on tape.
Oh, the bird. My father would love it, yeah.
I forgot the tape it is.
Yeah, I was so proud.
Yeah, yellow fish.
I remember the day I got promoted to colonel. And it wasn't just a rubber stamp that people got promoted to colonel. And I was so proud when I got that. And then the day when I became Dr. Sandy Venegoni. And I remember going back to Walter Reed asking some of the people, well, does doctor come first or does colonel come first? And there was a big discussion about that in our area, and it's like, well, if you're doing something military, it's colonel. If you're doing something civilian, it's doctor.
So it's colonel, doctor.
Colonel,
doctor.
Doctor,
colonel.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think it makes that much difference where people come from as much as what they're willing to be open and learn when they go into the military. And if you have, it helps a lot to have good role models because it is a new and different world in many ways. And I think I had some advantages coming from a military family, even though it's a different country and it's different in many ways. It's still something that you know that you have to do certain things.
But you also were a great role model to many younger people and a mentor to many younger people who then turned around and were mentors to other people.
I know, that was a nice part about her. If you do it yourself, then you're going to keep
it. Did she tell you she was almost a general?
She did not tell me that. You can tell me. What?
Well, you know, they used to not be colonels in the military for a long time.
Right.
Or any of the ranks. When they finally got ranked, I don't remember the history of it all now, when what was what, but colonels hadn't been that long. And the first general came out, it was a big deal. And, of course, it was only active duty. The first reserve general was, what's her name, Pockington, wasn't it? Yes, it was.
Yes.
And the second one was the one that really
two very capable women up for position, and it became a political intervention between two men as to whose nurse was going to become. Don't put that on tape. Maybe we shouldn't put that on tape. Don't type that.
We can edit this in the transcript and not have it published. Okay. You just say that when we read the transcript.
But Ami kept saying, I don't want to be a general, because if I become general of the Army Nurse Corps Reserve, then I'm not with the unit. And had she be had she been selected?
I would not have been with my troops during Operation Desert Storm, and I couldn't think. So I'd be sitting in the Pentagon, and I couldn't imagine anything worse. Everybody thought I was crazy. What do you mean you don't want to be a general? Well, I didn't. I liked the title colonel better anyway, but I certainly did not want to become a general and sit in the Pentagon when all of my people were going to go to Desert Storm. And it was that, right at that time that the first general was made.
That it was happening at that. Yes. The timing of it was pretty...
Yes, yeah. Now, later on, I may have felt different about it, but I surely wasn't going to leave my people at that time after having spent all those years with them to sit in some fancy office.
I have 4 minutes.
And then you'll self-combust, or...
No, we're going to be out the door.
No, I know.
Just lock the door as you leave.
Yeah, well, no, he's coming with us, isn't he?
Yeah.
Unless you stay
here.
Okay. Well, I can pack up in 4 minutes. So, well, thank you both so very much. I'll come back here and talk to you every week.
Okay. Good. You have our name and number. Do you have a card? Leave us your card so we can find you.
We'll show you some more of Carol.
Okay, we'll do that. Well, let me pack up, so I'll shut this off. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome.